Hey, good to have you here today. If you're new here today, just introduce myself. My name is Campbell, and it's my privilege today to come as one of the pastors here and just to bring some teaching from God's Word to you today. The topic of today is an easy one to remember because it's the same one all year long. The topic is love, and so we're still there. We're in May. And we are finally getting to the part of how we might express love. This year's been a lot about God's love for us so far. Yesterday I was at a wedding. Weddings are places where love is expressed, and where it's expressed heart and soul. And so we've been thinking the last couple of weeks around this commandment from God given through Moses at Mount Sinai, to the people of Israel, to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. And it's interesting that Jesus, he reinforces that same call and says it's the greatest of all commands. And so we're considering the last couple of weeks about what it means to love God, heart and soul. It was interesting at the wedding yesterday, there was this moment at the wedding that was just the most priceless, precious moment for me. Jonathan and Stephanie from this church got married. Jonathan's sort of from South Africa and UK, and he's now here in New Zealand, and Stephanie's a local girl here in Hamilton. And as they got married, there was all the expressions of love, you know, like we were out at the Arboretum in the storm that cleared for an hour while they got married, which was cool, and they got to express their love to each other like in vows and in those little looks. And then a much too long, a kiss the bride at the end. And then we went into Claudelands, into one of the sheds there for the reception. And there were all the speeches and lots of expressions of love. It was a beautiful day. The heart and soul expression of love that I saw, that was the moment that captured my heart, was not Jonathan to Stephanie or Stephanie to Jonathan. Though that was the obvious one. There came a moment where Jonathan's doing his speech, and for those of you who know him, he's a pretty emotional guy, and they talked about him wearing his heart on his sleeve or in his eyes or down his face. He cries a lot, and so he's trying to say his speech, and in the South African way, they have his best mates are in front of him on chairs, and they're meant to be there as the guys who mock him and give him flack as he tries to give his speech. It's sort of a thing they do. And so they were saying it was really hard to do that while your guy up the front is crying all the time, you know. So he's expressing his love to lots of people in his way. But there came this moment where I was sitting over the table from Roy, which is Jonathan's granddad. And I've had a few conversations with Roy over the last couple of months while he's been here in New Zealand. And he's from South Africa, and as Jonathan expressed right from his deep inner being, his heart, but with his soul, with his whole person, he expressed his love to his granddad. That was the moment I saw of the day where I just went, that was amazing. Like he expressed that he hadn't, you know, been able to keep communication going with his granddad like he wished, but he wanted to express his love for his granddad. And I was looking across the table, not at Jonathan, because he's crying the whole time anyway, but I was watching Roy, his granddad, and he's in his 80s, and I watched the look on his face and his receiving of the expression of love, and it was just so beautiful. Like, and the tears were welling, and he was holding it together, you know, but it was like... You could just see him receive love in a very precious way from his grandson. And I think that in that moment you're seeing love, you know, in that moment was being expressed heart and soul from one to another. And in that case it was at a distance across a room, it was in words, it wasn't, you know, body language and look, but there was something special in that. And I think as we look at today, you know, a couple of weeks ago we started on this idea of what does it look like to love heart and soul. Well, I think loving heart and soul is something that has to be expressed, and maybe we'll learn more about what it looks like as we start to look at how love might be expressed, what it would look like to express our love. I just want to give you a couple of definitions to remind you of some things we said 2 weeks ago around this. The love that we are called to show, and specifically called to show our God, our Creator, is a love that chooses to show itself in affection and action continually. As we looked at what that word love meant, like in the Hebrew and in the Greek, it carries with it this idea of choice. Somebody chooses to love. It's not just like it comes and gets you by surprise with some little emotion. It's actually a choice. But it does show itself in affection. There is emotion with it. There is affection with it. But there's also still this choice where love acts. Love does good for the other person. But also it's something that's continual. There's something about this love that we're called to that's what you'd call steadfast or continual or constant. And then as we thought about the heart being the deepest inner self, and our soul is like the complexity of our whole self. This is how I would define it. To love God with all our heart and soul is to choose to give all of myself to God and for the good of God continually. It's when I make that choice, like that choosing love that the Bible talks about, when I choose to give all of who I am to him and for his good, for the good of God, for what he wants in this life, in my life and in this world, and continually. This love, this giving of myself to God, this affection and action for God needs to find expression. It's not just something we talk about. It's not just something that maybe in one moment we might feel. Our love needs to be expressed. And so here's a couple of questions just to think about as we begin, and we'll come back to some of these later. How do I express my love to God? I mean, you might think about, how do I express my love to my kids? How do I express my love to my friend? How to express my love to my neighbor? And you might be able to attach some things to that. But just for a moment, think, how do you express your love to God? Another way of saying that might be, how do I best connect with God? Like, what does it look like, this relationship that you have with Jesus Christ? What does it look like to connect in that relationship, to really engage with him? How do I engage with him in thought and in conversation? And how do I show him my affection and adoration? Really comes back still to the first question. How do I express my love to God? There's this obvious place that we can start. Like if you're familiar with the Bible and you think, oh, expressing my love to God, there's a real obvious place we go. And it's the Jewish songbook, if you like. You could actually call it the heart and soul songs of Israel, and they're called the Psalms. Just listen to these words. This is a Psalm of David, Psalm 108. He starts and says, my heart, this inner, deep inner self, O God, is steadfast, and I will sing and make music with all my soul. It's interesting, he's wanting to make music to God, and we think of music, what, is he going to go play the piano or play the guitar or the gittith, as they call it? I don't know what that is, but we're going to find out a little bit more about the use of that, I guess, later. But he's saying, with my all of my soul, with all of my being, he's saying, it's almost like somehow his emotions and his will and his intellect and even his physical body, his whole being is involved in this making of music to God. Psalm 84. Some of the Psalms have these little headings. This one is for the director of music according to the gittith, which the gittith is the musical instrument by which you play to sing the song to. It's accompanied by the gittith. I don't know if it's a guitar. I don't actually know. And in fact, the more I read about it, no one really knows what a gittith is. But anyway, you play the gittith and you sing the song, and the song is written by the sons of Korah. It says this, how lovely is your dwelling place, Lord Almighty. How lovely is your dwelling place. How lovely is your home. How lovely is the place where we find you. My soul yearns, even faints, for the courts of the Lord. He's saying my soul, my whole being is, as it were, just aching to be with you where you are at home. Aching to be present where you are present, God. My heart and my flesh cry out for the living God. So the Psalms are these songs that are earnestly seeking God. And it's in the Psalms that we find an encouragement to express our love and worship for God. So as you go through the Psalms, you can actually sort of make a list of all the different expressions that we could make to God to show our love and our adoration of him. So in the Psalms, sometimes they call us to speak. Sometimes they call us to shout aloud. And sometimes they call us to sing. We're called to bow down. You know, we're encouraged to stand before God. Called to dance before him, to make music, to clap our hands, to raise our hands, to be still. So these are all just different valid expressions. What's interesting is that all these different expressions are valid in showing our love for God, but they're not the only ways that we might show our love for God. And the other interesting thing is that times certain expressions that the Psalms have would be really appropriate and other times would be inappropriate. Because each one has its context to what it is expressing in the adoration and love of God. I think that who is expressing their love to God and when they are and where they are and what they are expressing about will have an important bearing on how we express our love for God. So initially today was going to be about looking at all these different expressions and trying to figure out how they fit for us and how we could use them and all that. And as I was doing that, I was going, I feel like, and for some people this might not be a journey, but I feel like, you know, we're actually past that. Like if you feel prompted to raise your hands to God or to sit quiet and still before him, whether that's here or at home or on a mountaintop, I think what we do know is that there's a whole lot of expressions that you can explore and that might fit you or might not. I mean, but I think what's more important is going, who are you in this? Who are you who would come and bow before him? Who are you who would come and raise your hands to him? Who would you who would come and sit still before him? Who would you be who would shout and sing? And when would you do that and why would you do that? And as I was looking at that, I thought, man, I just was drawn to two characters in the Bible who I think are worshippers of God, people who love God. And I thought, let's just go and look at their lives because they actually give great example of people who have various expressions of love for God, expressions that we find in the Psalms and elsewhere. And the first one we go to, he's like the obvious one because he wrote most of the Psalms, and that his name is David. David was king of Israel, an incredible man and king and leader and shepherd. He was the king of a nation, the shepherd of sheep and of people. Some called him the sweet psalmist of Israel, this man called David. He's probably the most well-known worshipper of God, lover of God. And some of the songs that we sing are based on his songs, that he made music in his soul. There's this psalm in Psalm 8 by David, Psalm 8 verse 1. And this is for the director of music, according to the Gittith again, a psalm of David. It's possible that David, who was sort of like what you call an enthusiastic naturalist, that's what we might label him as far as how he expresses his love and his worship of God. You're likely to find him loving God with all his heart out on a mountainside, singing his heart out, playing the gittith, whatever that is. And he's probably surrounded by sheep as like his close audience, but really God is his audience. And possibly he's out there late at night looking after his sheep, playing his gittith, singing to God. But listen to the words that he sings. Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory in the heavens. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place, what is mankind that you are mindful of them, human beings that you care for them? Will you imagine David for a moment? This gives us insight as to who he is. So from a young age, he's been out on the land, and he's cared for sheep. He's a shepherd. And it wouldn't surprise me if even in years later when he becomes king, there's still a sense in which he longs to be back out on the mountainsides, away from the crowds, away from all the pressures of life, to be in that place where he found his best connection with God, where he could express his love to God. And it's interesting that as he's out there in this psalm, he's just declaring God's greatness, the majesty of God. But interesting at what prompts him to love God and how his expression flows. He's looking at the heavens. He's amazed at the stars. He's amazed at the moon. And he's seen it all before. Maybe that's part of what amazes him, is that this is a constant. And this is beyond his world. And as he sees it, he knows that God set that in place. And he sees how magnificent that is. And then he starts to see himself. And he sees life and humanity. And he goes, wow, God, you set that in place? Who am I? Who am I that you would even give a thought about me? You keep all of that in amazing order. And from the stars and the moon and this whole thing, and I don't know if he had a concept of universe or not, but everything seems to be in order, and the seasons and the rising of the sun and the sun going down and the moon and all of that. You care about this whole massive world. You would care for me? You see his heart? He's overwhelmed by what he sees when he gets out there on a mountainside. But he doesn't worship the mountain or the stars or the moon. His love, his affection, his adoration is towards the maker of those things. And it's not just that he's going, you are great creator, get this. He's going, you are great creator who thinks about me, who cares for me. This is personal for David. And what's amazing is there's a whole book of this stuff in Psalms where he just gives such expression of his soul, and we might go, oh, he wrote a great songbook. He didn't write a songbook. The songs in the songbook are him making music with his whole soul to his God. And we get to benefit from that today. There's something probably been more popularized about David and his worship. There, obviously, there's all these songs, and as you go through them, that they are actually food for our soul, and they help us to give expression. And if you haven't journeyed the Psalms, I'd encourage you to read them, but read them slowly and allow them to really soak into you, because often they'll give expression of things maybe you haven't been able to. But the thing that David's really famous for about worship is this time when he unashamedly and supposedly half naked danced before God and the people as the Ark of the Covenant, this treasure, was brought into Jerusalem. And in the story, this it's sort of been sensationalized, this thing of David dancing and whirling around. It's almost like everybody's just going like, what's the king doing, you know? And the king's just whirling and dancing around, and he's sort of exposing himself. He's all just about only got his underclothes on, like he's just in his undies, and he's dancing around. And that's the picture that's been painted for years. So I was having a look at it and reading it, and this is actually what it says about the story. So you don't believe everything you hear until you read it for yourself, okay? So it says this in 1 Chronicles 15. Now David was clothed in a robe of fine linen, as were all the Levites who were carrying the ark. That gives you a clue, doesn't it, what he's wearing? He's wearing the same as all the servants of the tabernacle. So he's not just in his undies. He's actually got a robe of linen on. And as were the musicians and Kenaniah who was in charge of the singing of the choirs. David also wore a linen ephod. It's like this overgarment that some say sat right over here or maybe around here, over this linen garment, linen robe. So all Israel brought the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord with shouts and with the sounding of ram's horns and trumpets and of cymbals and the playing of lyres and harps. So here's the picture. All of Israel, David's called together, and they're all coming into Jerusalem, and they're all actually worshipping the Lord. And David, with his robe on, not dressed in his kingly robe like normal. He's gone, I'm going to be amongst you, the people, amongst the servants of God, dressed as the servants are, and I'm going to worship with you. It's almost like what David does. He comes from his kingly position. He's still leading, but he comes and he leads amongst the people as one of the people, and he leads them in the worship of God as the significant day takes place. And then it says this is sort of like the scandalous piece that comes. It says, as the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord was entering the city of David, Michal, daughter of Saul, this was David's wife, watched from a window, and when she saw King David dancing and celebrating, she despised him in her heart. And in the other text, it tells us that she tells him off because he's been exposing himself before the young maidens of the land. And it's quite likely that what she's despising is that he's gone from his kingly position and become commonplace amongst the common people. And so that's David. So what do we learn about him from that? Well, what I love about David and that is he is the enthusiast. He's not afraid to express himself. But he's also the leader who leads others in enthusiastic expression. The description of the celebration before this, when the ark was first being transported and never made it to Jerusalem. So the ark came towards Jerusalem twice. The first time when it came, they transported it incorrectly. And as a result, it was going to fall off a cart and somebody went to touch it and they died. And so they left the ark where it was because they were scared of it. And then they came back a second time to bring it in. It's interesting what it says about the first time. It gives us insight as to what was going on as they came into the city to worship. So 2 Samuel 6 says this. 2 Samuel 6 and verse 1. David again brought together all the able young men of Israel, 30,000 of them. This is like his military men. This is his army. He and all his men went to Bala in Judah to bring up from there the Ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord Almighty, who is enthroned between the cherubim on the Ark. David and all Israel were celebrating with all their might before the Lord, with castanets, harps, lyres, timbrels, sistrums, and cymbals. So the picture there is that you've got David with his mighty men, and you know, on one day they might head on out to battle, and when they went to battle, it's full on, right? You don't go to battle half-hearted. You go to battle fully focused, fully ready. He takes the same crew of guys, 30,000 of them, and he says, today we will take the ark to Jerusalem, and we will celebrate before the Lord. And they go and they celebrate with all their might, the same fervor that they would go into battle with. That's the picture. So forget, David is amongst his people, leading them in this enthusiastic expression. He's an enthusiastic worshipper. Now, here's what you've got to remember about David. This isn't saying that you and I have to all get our, you know, dance on and be a David dancing before God. But it's also not necessary that we shouldn't do that. It's just not telling us that that's who we should be. It's interesting that that is who David is. He's a passionate guy. He's enthusiastic about everything he does. In fact, you could say this about David, is this is so much who he is that, in fact, this is the very thing that often gets him in trouble. It's his passion about life that also gets him in trouble, as well as his passion about life that sets him apart as a great example in other parts of his story. When he focused on the God he loved, he led the people in an amazing way. Now, the other thing about David is David grew up in a culture that loved to express itself enthusiastically. And so if you rewind the story of Israel and you go way back to when they were being freed from Egypt and they come across the Red Sea, and then God destroys Pharaoh and his army in the sea, what happens when they arrive at the other side? Well, Moses, the leader, leads the nation in song. And then Miriam leads all the young women from the nation, and they pick up their timbrels, their tambourines, and they sing and they dance in celebration to God. If you come forward towards David's time, when David slays the giant Goliath, and then him and Saul go out to battle, and when they come back in from battle, it's all the women of the town, the women of the city, the women of the nation will come out with their tambourines, and they sing and they dance and they sing of David and they sing of Saul. And so on this day when they're bringing the ark in, it would be the normal thing in their culture that's developed in Israel that they would come and they would play these instruments and they would sing and dance before the Lord. The interesting thing that David does, and sometimes I wonder if we need to break our cultural boundaries sometimes for the sake of glorifying God, is that what maybe Michael's saying at that point is, David, what are you doing? This is what the women do in Israel. They dance before the Lord with tambourine. What are you doing, my husband? Going down as one of the women dancing. It's not just that he's just doing that. He's bringing all the men with him to celebrate and to dance. It's just something to think about. I think David's way of expressing to God, responding to him, loving and worshiping him, was shaped by his culture, was shaped by his own personal journey as a shepherd, as a warrior, as a fugitive, as a king, but was also uniquely designed by God who created him. As some of us look at David, some of you will consider David and his expression of song, his expression in dance, and you would actually admire that. You'd go, man, that is cool, that's me. Some of you go, man, I wish that was me, but that's not me. And some people look at it and go, like, I don't even get that about David. And some of you might not even like that about David. One of the things that we find as we go through God's word and we look at the different characters and then we look in our own lives and our own communities, we find we're all really different. You heard Julie and Dee last week sharing about how they expressed their love for God, very different from each other. David was also very unique. I want to think of another person and consider Jacob. Jacob was like a great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather of David. And Jacob is a worshipper of God. He loves God. When we think about who loves God in the Bible and who worships God, we straight away go to David. But I don't know if we straight away ever think of Jacob as somebody who worships God. It's funny, I do. I discovered this a few years ago when reading through the story of Jacob. And now when I think of worship, often I'm drawn to think of Jacob as somebody who worshipped and loved God. And I'll tell you why. Hebrews 11, you know, the chapter that tells us about these amazing men and women of faith and what that looked like in their lives. And it's sort of like a hall of fame. Well, in verse 21, look at these words. Let's have a look at this. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of Joseph's sons and worshipped as he leaned on the top of his staff. Now, it's interesting that out of all the characters who are commended for their faith and they're commended for different things that they did to express their faith, to express their devotion to God, the one that gets credited with worship is Jacob. It's like it says there that as he's blessing his son and leaning on his shepherd staff and worshiping God, that he did all of that by faith. And he's credited with that. He's commended for that. I would describe Jacob, however, when he was younger, as not being like a worshiping blesser, but he was more like a wrestling grabber. And I'll describe that to you. From the very womb when Jacob came out, he was about a fight. He was about seeking to grab stuff and to wrestle what he could get. This is what it says in Genesis 25, 26. So Esau is born. He's the oldest of twins. It says, after this, his brother came out with his hand grasping Esau's heel. So he was named Jacob. So you might say he didn't know what he was doing, but it's interesting that as Jacob's coming out of the womb, I don't know how that was happening, he's got a hold of his twin brother's heel. So Esau's firstborn, but Jacob's got a hold of his foot as he comes out. So we won't even go there other than he's the grabber, okay? Now, what's interesting as the story unfolds and these two boys, these twins grow older, Jacob also grabs Esau's birthright. Jacob also grabs Esau's blessing. Jacob he's up for the fight. He's always grabbing what he wants. He sees something, he gets it. There's this amazing part of him. It's even as he flees his home because Esau's so mad with him and wants to kill him. And so as Jacob's fleeing from his brother, and he comes to this place called Bethel where he encounters God, and God appears to him, and God promises him on this day, God promises him all the blessings of his grandfather Abraham. So God's making a promise. Do you know what Jacob does when he gets a promise from God? He seeks to do a deal with God. This is the kind of guy Jacob is. He's a wrestling grabber. He's going, oh, it's not like, oh, God, thanks so much for promising me that. I'll seek to be faithful to you. He's going, God, if you will be with me and watch over me on this journey that I'm taking and will give me food to eat and clothes to wear so that I return safely to my father's house, then the Lord will be my God. Do you see the deal he's doing? He's going, great promise. Promise of my grandfather Abraham, thanks for that, God. But really, as long as you do all these things for me, then you can be my God. Yeah, well, so why is he credited with being a worshiper? Like, when he's got that kind of attitude. So what happens is he continues on and he grabs a wife or two, and he grabs flocks of sheep and of goats. He's not a thief. But he's a very cunning businessman. He gets what he wants. But what I find interesting about Jacob is rather than always seeing him as the grabber, I'm interested to see what he's wanting to grab. And primarily this is what I see. He wants the blessing of God. We can be down on him because, man, you're just after stuff. But it seems that he wants more than that. He really does want the blessing of God. And I don't think that's a bad thing. Some of his methods are questionable. And there comes this final day where he's got this whole family now and he's got lots of possessions and he's on his way back to his homeland. And as he's going there, he's really afraid because his brother Esau still lives there, and he's thinking that even though years have gone by, that Esau's going to have it in for him. And as he's about to encounter Esau, he prays to God. And this is his prayer from Genesis 32. O God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, Lord, you who said to me, go back to your country and your relatives and I will make you prosper. I am unworthy of all the kindness and faithfulness you have shown your servant. I had only my staff when I crossed this Jordan, but now I have become two camps. Save me, I pray, from the hand of my brother Esau, for I'm afraid he will come and attack me and also the mothers with their children. But you have said, I will surely make you prosper and I will make your descendants like the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted. It's almost as if that deal he made with God, the years have gone past and he's put the deal to the side. Do you see that? He's almost just gone, oh, actually, God, it is all about you. On this day, he's crying out to his God because he's scared. But he also feels unworthy of God's kindness and goodness to him. And it's like on this day, he's trusting God as he expresses his devotion to God. And then this interesting story takes place where the wrestling still happens. And you read on in the chapter, verse 24. So Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him till daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, let me go, for it's daybreak. But Jacob replied, I will not let you go unless you bless me. So he's still the wrestling grabber. He wants the blessing. The man asked, what is your name? Jacob, he answered. Then the man said, your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with humans and have overcome. There's a strange thing there that we could see the wrestling side, the grabbing side of Jacob as a real negative, and yet this is who he is. He sees something good and he wants it. He wants the blessing of God. And it's as if God says, you have strived for this and I'm going to give it to you. your name Jacob, which means like grabber, I'm going to give you a new name that symbolizes what I'm giving you. And the new name, Israel, means the one who strives with God. That's quite a different name. The grabber, God, give me this. No, but what about the one who strives with God, is earnestly seeking, God, I want more of you. I want your blessing in my life. I want your presence in my life. I want you in my life. Without you, I am nothing. He becomes Israel, the one who strives with God. And then many years later, and his family has grown, this shepherd once who crossed the Jordan, remember, with a staff in his hand, he'd said, he now leans on it. And he's blessing his sons, like it says in Hebrews. He's leaning on his staff, his shepherd's staff, and he's giving blessing to his son as he worships God. And this is what it said in Genesis 48. May the God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked faithfully, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who has delivered me from all harm, may he bless these boys. May they be called by my name and the names of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and may they increase greatly on the earth. I love that. It's like you've got this guy who's been the wrestling grabber and suddenly he's like the worshipping blesser. He's leaning on a staff. And in this point, as he no longer is seeking to grab but to give, he wants to be a giver. He wants to be a blesser. And he's blessing his grandkids and his two grandsons, and he's blessing his own sons. And as he's a giver, he's a worshiper. Look at what it says there. May the God before whom my father Abraham and Isaac walked faithfully, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day. Do you hear Jacob's heart there? You know, there was that other shepherd, David. He's on a hillside, and he sees the stars and the moon, and he sees how small he is, and he considers that relationship, and he expresses his love to God. What is man that you would give thought of him? What are we human beings that you would care for us? That's David. Here you've got Jacob, a very different person, who's been wrestling all his life, striving for things, but then eventually striving with God. And then on this day, what does he do? He's not looking to the heavens, to the stars. He's looking back. It's almost like he's very contemplative, looking back on a long life. And he's not doing a dance, and he's not shouting out loud. I just imagine he's just quietly there, leaning on his staff, and there's Joseph, his son he loves, and his two grandsons. And he's just going, boys, may my God, who all my days, as ratbag as they were, who's been my shepherd, and I know what a shepherd is because we're a shepherding family. We care for the sheep. May my God, who has cared for me as one of his sheep all my days, that God who's been my shepherd, may he bless you. It's just a beautiful picture. And the story doesn't end there. You go to verse 33 and it says this of Jacob, the one who sought to hold things so tightly at the beginning. Comes to the end of his days and you watch him do this. You listen to the words. When Jacob had finished giving instruction to his sons, he drew his feet up into bed, breathed his last, and was gathered to his people. I don't think it's without intention that that's written there of this peaceful death. This man who'd strived all life long, wrestling, and it comes to his final days. It's almost as if you read it, you just go, he just lets it go as he goes to be with his God. In some ways, you could describe Jacob as like almost like an intellectual activist who's so clever and he's thoughtful and he's thinking of the promises and how he can line them up to his benefit and he's seeking God. But he's also very active and hardworking and busy, and yet you see his life change, and sometimes our lives change as he becomes so much more reflective and becomes more generous and becomes a worshiping giver. So what do you do with David and Jacob? They're two quite different characters. I'm not suggesting that you should be a David or a Jacob, but what I'm suggesting is these two men that we have here in these stories tell us that we're all very different. That we may be the enthusiastic worshipper. We may be the naturalist who needs to get out on a mountaintop. We may be the person who needs to be able to think through the processes and the theology and the who is God and how does it work and how does life work and what does blessing and cursings look like. And we might be right in that. We might be the activist who needs to be hard at work trying to make things happen. But in all of that is our heart and our soul towards God. Because what I see in these two men's lives is that there's these great seasons where their heart and soul is towards him. If David was here today, maybe he'd be along with Dave up here and he might be rocking it out on a guitar and might add a bit of screamo in there at times if he's in the mood, declaring, God is good. But I could also see him putting his backpack on and joining me up on Porongia to just sit and watch the sunrise and be in awe of all that God has made and be in wonder that he would care for me. And then you see Jacob, and you might think, man, he's probably the guy that's working long hours to make a buck. But then as you uncover a story, it's not really about him. He's doing it for the future for others because he wants to leave something for those he leaves behind. He wants to make a difference. And then in his later life, you'd imagine, if Jacob was here at church, in his later life, I imagine he'd be sitting down the back, just looking around, taking it all in, looking and thinking, I remember that, I remember then, I remember that person's story, I remember that family, what happened there, I remember when that happened to me. Man, God has been good, shepherding us all our days. A few weeks ago, I ran in a race. In the south of France, I was privileged to go to this race. I got in on 2 weeks' notice to this race that had sold out in November. I went online and was cheeky and went to the organizer and said, I've got a spare day where I could actually make it to the Mid-Pyrenees and go in your race in the mountains. And I do a marathon a week, and they're not official ones. Your one is, but I want to come to your official one. Can you let me in? And he said, yeah, I own the event. I can do what I please. That's his literal words. You can come and race at my race. And he says, because you're a New Zealander, like, you can be like our international competitor. So I had to let him know that I'm not actually like competitive and that my times are pretty slow. And he goes, no, that's all cool. So I went and I did this race in the Mid-Pyrenees. It was very cool. Just a great experience. It's interesting, in the race, you're running through these mountains, and I'm with about 1,500 other runners. They're all French, and then there's me. And I had a New Zealand flag on my back, and people would see it, and they would go like, All Blacks, because they're really into rugby in the south of France. And we had a lot of fun that day. It hurt a lot, but it was a lot of fun. And I wasn't competitive. What was interesting that day in the race is that the race was not all about the runners. I love running, and I love the event. And I'm the enthusiast. And I love running in the outdoors, so that naturalist thing, you know, what we talked about, David, is a bit like that. So I'm not going to break out into dance anytime, but I will be passionate about what I do. And so I'm out there, and I'm loving the race, and I'm running the race, and I'm enjoying every element of it. I'm very in the moment. Now, also in the race are the spectators. And in the south of France, I love the spectators. My favourite spectators, and I saw several of them, were shepherds leaning on staffs at the gate with their sheepdogs. And you would pass a guy here, and then you pass two guys here, and they'd be chewing the fat. And they're out there for the whole day watching all these idiots run around the mountains. They're leaning on their staff, and they've got their dog, and they're chatting. And they're part of the race too. They're part of what makes that race. What's interesting in the race is that there's a whole lot of us that are enjoying, taking great joy out of this event. Now, I could come along and go, what the heck are you guys doing there? Like, leaning on your staffs, chatting away. Get in the game here, guys. Like, you're missing the opportunity. And they might be over there and going, man, these idiots who keep running past, why don't they stop and just smell it and soak it in and come over and we'd give them something to eat and we could sit down and chat for a while. And we're so different, but we're in the same race. And sometimes I think in life, we can be worried about how other people are enjoying the race and not realizing that they are. And we're different. And I can't help but think of like Jacob and David, and I was thinking of this race. It's like, it's a little bit like the guy at the gate and then the runner. They're so different, but both taking great joy in the race. The important thing is on that day was that I was taking my great joy by running the race, and this guy is taking great joy by being a spectator, but we were both in the race. And I think of this thing of loving God and worshiping him, and I go, we could look at how we might do that and criticize somebody else and go, why aren't you doing this with me? And vice versa. That's not the issue. The issue is, are we in it? Are we worshippers? Are we expressing our love? Are we finding voice for that, expression for that? If we're not, if we're somewhere back at home, still in bed or watching telly or whatever, and we're missing the race, then we're really missing it. But as we'd come out to the race, as it were, whether taking this posture of just reflection and soaking it in and enjoying that, or whether wanting to be competing and sweating it up, the joy is still there. And I just think that's what we're saying. Get in a way in the race. Get in this thing called loving God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. Find expression of your love for God, for he so loves you. So loves you. And what we want to do is over the next few weeks, we're going to look more at that, but today, right now, we want to pause and give expression to our love to God. And there's nothing like radically new today that we're going to do, but these are some of the things that we sometimes do here to try and give voice and expression of our love to God. And as we go, I'm just going to give description of this, and then we're going to take about 10 minutes to just come and to love God. In a way, I just say, just come and be in the race right now. Experience the joy of loving him right now. And whether you do that from your seat or whether you get up for that, that's your choice. Just go to those questions, thanks. Just before we do that, I just want us to pause. We haven't had these up for a couple of weeks, and these are our questions for the year as we approach each week and we come and we listen to God's word and then also listen to each other. As you would look at that, maybe there's one of those questions that would stand out for you. But I sort of wonder about the final question: how does any of this connect with your world? And the little card you've been given, I guess, is an access point into that question. Is what does this mean to you? What does expression of love to God mean to you? Not to the person next to you or to CBC or how we do church, but what does this mean for you? How does this connect to you and who you are in your world today?